One of the first things Sally Field ever performed in front of an audience was a scene from Romeo and Juliet that she'd practiced with her mom. She was 13.
And I was truly, I must have been dreadful. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was so seminal, so incredibly important, because I had this magical thing happen to me. I had no idea where I was going, and I didn't know how it arrived, but I had this glorious out-of-body experience. I was on stage saying words that I really didn't quite understand. I had no idea what a technique was or anything, and I simply floated away. I didn't exist. There was no Sally, little 13-year-old Sally on stage. There were hands and feet and a mouth working and saying things, but they weren't mine. And it is this blissful, glorious high that I had early on in my life, and it is what has taught me and guided me forever. Because when I lost sight of what on God's green earth was I doing here, why was I doing this, why was I beating myself up, I remembered that moment, and my whole life has been trying to understand how to get back there.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. On this episode, we've got a stunning, intimate interview with actor Sally Field. Some of her stories are painful, but in the end, they're a testament to endurance and reinvention. I'm Alice Winkler.
Madam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
Nia Bass says, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
If you're in your 60s, you might first picture Gidget when you hear Sally Field's name. That's the silly, surfing teenager she played on TV when she was herself still a teen.
Through this door passes the most miserable girl in the world, me, Gidget. And all because of having to take a miserable foreign language, English.
If you're in your 50s, your go-to Sally Field image is probably Sister Bertrille, better known as the Flying Nun, another kooky, adorable character, but this one able to soar through the air in a habit for some inexplicable reason.
We have a used clothes drive to worry about. And I'm going to start right now by going upstairs and packing up my old habit and cornet.
Those of you in your 40s, how about Edna Spaulding, the widow farmer from Places in the Heart, or the mighty Norma Rae, working class hero?
I'm gonna get fired.
I'll run your benefit.
Oh, thanks a lot. I got 3 kids, a drawer full of bills, and a husband who doesn't like what I'm doing.
You 30-year-old Sally Field probably entered your life as the ex-wife in Mrs. Doubtfire or Forrest Gump's mother.
I happen to believe you make your own destiny. You have to do the best with what God gave you.
What's my destiny, Mom?
You're gonna have to figure that out for yourself. Life is a box of chocolates, Forrest. You never know what you're gonna get.
And finally, you tender young 20-somethings, your first glimpse might have come watching ER when Sally Field played the bipolar mother of Dr. Abby Lockhart. Or maybe it was Brothers and Sisters, where she was the Walker family matriarch. Or might have been the movie Lincoln, where she embodied Mary Todd Lincoln.
You think I'm ignorant of what you're up to because you haven't discussed this scheme with me as you ought to have done? When have I ever been so easily bamboozled? I believe you when you insist that amending the Constitution and abolishing slavery will end this war. And since you are sending my son into the war, woe unto you if you fail to pass the amendment.
Okay, I think you get my point. Sally Field has thrived in television and movies and theater for 5 decades. It has been both a marathon and a sprint. As I write this, Sally Field is 70 and starring on Broadway in The Glass Menagerie. It is literally a dream come true for her. But as she told a crowd of students at the 2008 Academy of Achievement Summit, there were many times the end of her career seemed at hand. Here's an excerpt from that talk.
I have 2 things that are hanging in my office that I've had there a very long time. One of them is a quote and one of them is a cartoon. The quote is by the fabulous Agnes DeMille, and it is, "Living is a form of not being sure, not knowing what next or how. The moment you know how, you begin to die a little. The artist never entirely knows. We guess, we may be wrong, but we take leap after leap in the dark." And the cartoon that I have right next to it is a cartoon of this man standing with his face pressed up against 2 bars of his prison. And he's longingly looking out of his prison, wishing he were free, but he doesn't turn to look that there are no other bars on his prison, only the ones that he has his face pressed against. I have survived for almost 45 years in a business that has no tenure. I have learned how to survive, and probably more than that, because I've learned that the struggle is where the work is. The struggle is the work. I have learned to understand that, and I've learned to recognize transition, which was the very hardest thing to do. When I first started, it was in the 60s in situation comedy television. I did a television series called The Flying Nun. And if you don't think it wasn't hard to transition from that to being a serious actor, I've got news for you. I was also at a time when, believe me, situation comedy and television actors were not accepted in mainstream film. You were just not accepted. It wasn't that I couldn't pass the audition, it was that I couldn't get in the door. And I knew that it was up to me, that if I wasn't where I wanted to be, it was because simply I wasn't good enough, and I had to get better, and I did. I worked at it, I studied, and I studied, and I studied, and a moment happened. I can't say it was really an opportunity as much as it was, get out of my way, folks, here I come. And I got a role. I have learned not to panic at not knowing. I've learned how to fall and just fall. I have learned to let go of my own image of myself. This is so incredibly difficult, especially when you're working on such a grand scale as the public arena, any of us who do that. And the public forms an image of you, and you form an image of yourself, and you will have an image of yourselves. Everyone does. But to be able to lose that image and to recreate another one, or to allow yourself to exist without an image at all for a while, to allow yourself to leave off the thought of being an achiever, of being successful, of being good, just let it go until something else forms, and the longer you leave it off, the better. I have transitioned from television in a very difficult struggle to film. And when I was in film doing movies I was proud of, there I was. I'd worked so hard to be there, and the films weren't there. There were no films for women. I had to transition again. I was given the opportunity to develop and produce my own film, something I knew nothing about and had absolutely no desire to do. But I had to do it. I produced 5 of my own and directed 2, something I was never really sure I was very good at, but I transitioned. And then as my career went on, I realized now I was getting older, and I was in an industry that wants nothing whatsoever to do with older women. So what was I to do now? I was to transition yet again onto the stage. Probably the most profound learning experience of my life is I stood backstage at the Golden Theater waiting to go on stage in Edward Albee's wonderful play, The Goat. Standing there feeling the weight of Mr. Albee's gorgeous words and my own history, I felt myself sinking to the bottom of this dark, black abyss. My first instinct was to quickly struggle to the top. I needed to breathe. Help, get me to the top. But I knew then not to panic. I allowed myself to sink to this unknown darkness and to let go. I would just rely on and have the confidence that somewhere inside of me, I knew things.
Sally Field still today looks remarkably like that same girl who played Gidget on TV in 1965. But she is not the same. Her struggles and her victories have made her a philosophical and very mindful veteran actress. After delivering those remarks to students back in 2008, she sat down to talk to journalist Gail Eichenthal for the Academy of Achievement, and they covered a lot of ground, starting all the way back with Sally Field's parents.
I come from a real working-class acting family. It's not a glamorous life. My stepfather, who I grew up with, was a stuntman slash actor, but basically a stuntman. My mother, interesting, would 1 week go to work on Bonanza and then not work for a few weeks and then get a job on Perry Mason and then not work for a while and then get another job on another television series. So it was really the typical dangerous working class actor's life in that you never knew if you were going to have an income. It's a very difficult life. It's so incredibly insecure. And when I grew up, twice we had all our things in our house repossessed. And it was extremely influential to me to live in a house one day and then not the next.
And yet, her mother did not try to dissuade her from going into acting.
No. No, my mother certainly didn't. My mother, from the time I was little, even before she married my stepfather, my mother was under contract to Paramount. She was, in the days when they had contract players, she was spotted in the Pasadena Playhouse because she was incredibly beautiful. And then she studied with Charles Laughton. And she always had a great, deep love of the craft of acting because she sat in a small classroom with Charles Laughton and watched him perform all the time. And he was a phenomenal actor. So I grew up with her loving the classics, reading Chekhov and Shakespeare, and loving the real art of what acting is. And acting is storytelling. And it is a very interesting profession because if you study and you have a lot of techniques, you learn to step in someone else's shoes. Part of those shoes are created by history. You do research on who this person might have been. You use the text of the writer who has written it, but you really instill it with your own life. You find parts of yourself that actually link with that human being, even though they may be so... It's on the page, you go, how am I going to do this? There's no way I can relate to this person. And it transforms you as a person to stand in those shoes because you realize how you are linked to everyone, profoundly, deeply, emotionally linked. And I have been changed by the strong roles I've gotten to play of Norma Rae or Sybil and others. And I go away not the same. And it has made me wonder, was John Wayne John Wayne before he played those roles? Or did Red River change John Wayne and help him to develop to be the person that he became as a human being? I think it has to go hand in hand.
Acting started to change Sally Field from the beginning, which for her meant high school. Once she discovered the drama department, she practically started living there, she says, to the exclusion of pretty much everything else.
I was uneducated, basically, completely and utterly and totally uneducated. I barely went to classes. I only went to the drama classes. I wasn't really encouraged in my home as a female growing up in the 50s to be educated. It was a real lack. My mother did a lot of great things, but she wasn't educated, so she didn't know how to support that. And my brother, who became an elemental particle physicist, one of the finest physicists in the world, and I never went to college. And it really is, in a lot of ways, indicative of what our society was then. And I survived, and I taught myself, but deeply as a 61-year-old woman, and my sons would be here in the room going, oy, oy, here she goes. I have been possessed with this longing to have an education, a formal, sit in the classroom, write the paper, turn it in, get a B, wish for an A kind of education.
Her career took off so swiftly, though, it was a long while before she had that revelation.
I had just graduated. It was that summer of 1964. Had just graduated from high school. And no, my parents didn't say, Sal, maybe you ought to be taking the SATs and going to college. I had never been out of the state. I had never been on an airplane. I was so incredibly naive and unsophisticated. Didn't know that what I really wanted was to go to New York and study acting. Didn't know that it really existed. I knew New York was there. I didn't know about the Actors Studio. Even though my mother loved acting, it's a whole nother story. She sort of so focused on being married to who she was married to, she lost a lot of her own voice, I think is the truth.
Sally Field's stepfather was a famous Hollywood stuntman, a larger-than-life figure who had a lot of magnetism. But in her words, he terrorized the family.
I think in my now 60-some-odd years, he has been the biggest source of conflict as a person in my life, in trying to sort out really what my feelings were. He destroyed a lot of good things about his children, his stepchildren and his own children. But oddly enough, I think that I owe a great deal to how difficult he was. He was, it's like almost impossible to say right here. He was very aggressive, could be incredibly tyrannical. But I think as a child, the most damaging part of him is that he loved to humiliate. He loved to pick you apart and deeply humiliate you. I think he thought he was parenting. I'm not really sure. But I remember him telling me, I was the one that stood up. I was the one that wouldn't take it. I was the one that fought for my brother for whatever reason. I became, for other reasons that will go in the book, I became the focus of his tyranny. And I was terrified. I was terrified all the time. I was terrified at sleep. I was terrified awake. I was terrified that I would be forced to fight. And yet something in me wouldn't be quieted. And I remember him saying to me things like when I was 15, maybe, him rising up and being he was huge. He was a very big man, almost 6'5", and very handsome and charismatic in his way. Probably one of the finest stuntmen that ever lived. He would say to me, at this little 15-year-old girl pointing at me in this big threatening fashion, that he had this magic to identify everyone's Achilles heel. And I was like, wow, what is that? And that is to identify where it is you have this deep flaw. And if he were able to tell you what that deep personal flaw was, it would destroy you, because you wouldn't be able to handle that truth. And I remember sitting there hearing that at 15, going, bullshit. Part of me went, first of all, I'm not going to believe that. Second of all, could it possibly be true? Could there be something about me that I don't see, that's so horrifying that I don't want to know, that if he told me, it would destroy me? And I think what it did is it made it so that every flaw that I had, every weakness I had, every part of me that I didn't want to see, it was going to be what I wrote in with first. No one was going to be able to say anything to me that I didn't already know and accept about myself. So I think a lot of the things that were damaging to maybe my brother ultimately turned out for me to be the fight, the part of me that just simply wouldn't sit still. And even to this day, I have to watch myself. If someone says something that triggers me, I'll come flaring up in this way that I don't want to be that person. That's not what I want to be. But it triggers this old language that I had. And I have used it in my acting. It is my anger, my fury, my deep resentment at being manipulated like that. I have learned to own it, to use it, to propel me.
Back as a child, though, still living under her stepfather's roof, she was purely in survival mode, doing her best to protect herself and her older brother, whom she worshipped. Luckily, at 17, she got the chance to try out for a really big role on television, and with it would come the financial independence she'd need to leave home. But at the time, it didn't seem likely she'd get the part.
I went on the audition. Didn't know what to do. Completely naive. All these other girls had 8x10 glossies and agents. I had a wallet full of pictures of my friends. I came back, which seemed like forever. And at the end of the summer, I was doing a television series called Gidget. Yeah, and I was 17. So, bam, out of it, just into it, just flop into the world.
If you're in doubt about angels being real, can arrange to change any doubts you feel. Wait till you see my Gidget. You want her for your Valentine.
She was able to move out on her own and was having fun playing this super cute character, and somehow naively not thinking about the fact that millions of people were watching her.
I didn't ever think of that. I'm sure she was an icon to me, but I think the most important thing in Gidget is that she had a father. And I think it was this really turning point for me because I got to play a girl who had a father, and I didn't have one. And it was Don Porter, who was the most lovely, 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 loving man. And he was so terribly supportive to me in my awkwardness, in my newness, and I didn't read very well because I realize now I'm like slightly dyslexic in a way, especially when I get nervous. And we would do readings once a week for a while when we had time of the script. We'd sit down and do a reading, and I didn't know a lot of the words, and I was so unsophisticated. And I remember to this day some of the words I stumbled on, like mundane. I didn't know what that word was. And symbiotic. I didn't know what it was. And everybody got such a big kick out of me because I was 17 and sort of out there. And when they laughed, it deeply affected me because I was so used to humiliation. It was what I lived with, the threat that humiliation would come toward me and the form of my stepfather. So when we'd sit at the table and they'd laugh, it would be my trigger. I'd be like, oh my God. And he somehow, he couldn't have known, but he would sit next to me and he would whisper the word to me before a word would come up. It could be something simple. It could be like, he would whisper it to me. It was truly one of the most loving things from a man that had happened to me.
Gidge, I'll answer that question with another. You know what a paradox is?
Isn't it a statement that kind of contradicts itself?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So maybe you'll understand when I tell you that I love you so much, I'd do anything in the world for you. But because I do love you that much, I will not intercede between you and Hardy.
Sally Field's next role, one that would come to haunt her and threaten to cage in her career for years, was The Flying Nun. But it, too, came with lessons that she carries with her to this day.
Well, it's an interesting journey. I didn't want to do it. Gidget had stopped sort of prematurely, oddly, and I didn't have enough connection with my own voice to know that I needed to go and study and become what I wanted to become. I didn't know how to do that yet. I was 19, not quite, almost 19, somewhere in there, 19. And I kept turning it down. I didn't want to be a nun. I was a burgeoning young woman. It was the 60s. Everyone was running around naked and eating granola. And I didn't want to do that, but I didn't want to be a nun at all. I didn't want to be this silly thing. And again, it's such an interesting thing. I turned it down. It took great strength. I was already living on my own in an apartment by myself down the road, not that far away. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. You know, how very brave of me. I'm going to find something else I want to do. And my stepfather came over to my apartment one time and told me, and I subsequently realized it was because the producer, Harry Ackerman, had called him to do it. So I felt betrayed, ultimately. He said that I should do it because I may never work again. And I mean, those were like, I didn't know it then. I should have burst out laughing because that's like the cliche in the town, you know, like, shall we lunch? You know, it's like a cliche, you know, you'll never work again. But I was too young to know that I should have laughed. Instead, I got scared. And I thought, God, really? And I called them up and said, I guess I should do this. And they were already filming a pilot with somebody else. And they fired her. And they put me in the next day. And there it was. And I was really unhappy for all 3 years that I did it. Because part of me knew I had listened to a voice of fear that changed my life. That changed my life. That I knew then that voice of fear was something that I must never listen to. Fear of that. I must go to what desperately frightens me. Desperately frightens me is the chance of failure. Is the chance of not knowing, but not going to what is safe. And that's what my stepfather had urged me to do. And I tried to learn that. You know, ultimately, you look at these things, you look at these paths and these journeys you go on, and I think it's up to you to find the value in them, because there is value in all of them, even those that you would call, God, I shouldn't have done that. I should have done that. I needed to do that. I did that. And I was there for 3 years, and it was an invaluable education. It was not a very glamorous one. It was a successful one, and that the show was successful for 3 years. It would have gone on had I not begun to drag my feet so terribly and, you know, every night wish it ill. But what it did for me is that I met Madeline Sherwood, who was the actress who played Mother Superior, and I was so desperately unhappy. She said, come with me. And at the end of the first year of The Flying Nun, she took me to the Actors Studio to meet Lee Strasberg. And that was a monumental change in my life. And from then on, I would work in the daytime and doing The Flying Nun. And at night, I would be at the Actors Studio in L.A. because Lee Strasberg would be 6 months out of the year in L.A. And I would be doing just outrageous material that I still didn't quite understand. I was doing, you know, Sartre's Respectful Prostitute or whatever I could do that I thought was completely outside of what The Flying Nun was. But ultimately, I worked with Lee for on and off for about 10 years. And ultimately, I learned a craft. I learned to hear my voice of what I really wanted to do. And finally, when I was given the opportunity to do the work, I really knew how to do it.
Lee Strasberg, just to fill in here, was the man who revolutionized acting in America. He trained generations at the Actors Studio in what was simply called the method. But even though Sally Field was working double time to get to study with Strasberg, she was stuck in what then was a huge chasm between television actors and film actors.
I mean, television was thought of the, you know, the poor relation to film. There is still a little of that. There's still a little of that, a little of snobbery, a class system that existed. But in 1960, you know, late 60s, early 70s, it was impossible, especially if you came from something called the Flying Nun. It was impossible to make that transition. It just couldn't be done. It wasn't that I couldn't get the part. I couldn't get in the door. I couldn't get on the list, most especially because I was the Flying Nun. And it was an important journey to change that. It made me learn some really valuable lessons. And that is that if I wasn't where I wanted to be, it was because I wasn't good enough. Period. It wasn't because they weren't letting me in the door. It wasn't because they were against me or they thought I was something else or they. It was simply because I wasn't good enough. That the minute I gave my power away to them, I was lost. And I didn't try to get in the door. I didn't try. You know, I barely had an agent who cared whether I lived or died. And what was bizarre is that that's how it happened. That I worked so hard at the Actors Studio that I started to get this kind of little underground reputation. It was also during this incredible time in American film in the 70s when American film was changing. And at the Actors Studio was Ellen Burstyn and Jack Nicholson, and things were changing. And I got in on an audition, not because of my agent, but because of someone who had worked with me at the Actors Studio and told someone that people thought they knew who I was, but I wasn't that. And I came in on the audition, and by then I knew how to audition. I knew that I couldn't come in as Sally Field, this still rather unsophisticated person. I had to come in as the character. And it was for a film called Stay Hungry. Bob Rafelson, a wonderful director, certainly a really important time in American film. And I had to come and convince him that I was this absolute floozy, this tart, this sleep-around kind of girl, uneducated, southern, sleep-around, little floozy girl. And I was uneducated, but I wasn't any of the other things. But I knew how to be that character. I knew how to play the role. And I also knew that an audition starts from the moment I start to get dressed to leave the house. And the acting had to be that he had to then believe that everything else I'd done to that point, Gidget and the Flying Nun, was an incredible acting job, when really I was just this absolute tart. And that's what I did. And he he did everything he could do to not hire me. I heard him yelling at the casting person. I heard him yelling at her and saying, "Why would you waste my time? This is Sally Field, what are you thinking?" And of course, by then, I had had Lee Strasberg in my life, who was one of my important mentors, a phenomenal teacher, a really important and phenomenal teacher, who taught me how to use that in a way that wasn't going to get in my way, that it was fuel. And it was like, open the door and watch out. And I knew how to do it. And I did.
Bob Rafelson, who had directed the iconic Jack Nicholson film Five Easy Pieces, hired her after all. It was 1976, and it was her first substantial role since The Flying Nun had gone off the air 6 years earlier.
He did. I mean, it wasn't easy. I had to test. And he called everyone he knew, saying, "Could this be Paul?" And he would say just outrageous things to me. He would call me and say, "You can't possibly be the best one. You read best, but it must be because you've auditioned more than anyone else." I said, "This is the second audition I've ever been on in my life. First one was for Gidget." So, and bless his heart, Bob Rafelson, he had the guts to do it.
After the filming was done, the casting director for Stay Hungry called to say she had another interesting project, and she wanted Sally Field to audition for it. It was Sybil, about a girl with multiple personality disorder, or what we now call dissociative identity disorder. Sally Field happened to be reading the book at the time that the TV miniseries would be based on.
I knew in my heart that it was mine. I knew that I was the girl to play it. For so many reasons, I linked with her. Even just physically, because I have a childlike quality that I have fought against all my life, but there it is. And because of some troubled things in my life, I knew that this had to be mine. And again, it was this amazing battle to get the role.
Stay Hungry hadn't come out yet, so she was still plagued by the curse of the Flying Nun.
And all these wonderful actresses wanted to do this role. I mean, Vanessa Redgrave wanted to do this. I mean, these are like, and here was little me. But again, I just, you know, knew this was mine. I came in as Sybil, which was difficult because I wasn't sure which one of the Sybils I was going to be. But I came in on the audition as the Sybil herself, the core Sybil that is without people, that is just vapid, you know, vacant soul that's frightened of people, that can barely look up, that's dour and dirty and cannot deal with mankind because all of her gifts and all of her colors are somewhere else with other voices that will be revealed. I decided to come in as her, and people were like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, this is very, I mean, we had no idea that Sally Field was so terribly drab and depressed. I mean, what is the deal? And they kept saying, this can't be true. She can't be the one. It can't be her. But a magical thing happened, and that was that I had the opportunity to do a test with Joanne Woodward. And I love it. Again, it was this one of these moments in my life where I instantly fell in love with someone like Dawn Porter. She opened her heart and her arms, and she and I didn't know, I hadn't met her. And I did one of the scenes with her that one of the characters was emotional and carrying on and crying. And I remember kneeling on the ground and laid my head in her lap and sobbed. And she picked my face up, and I took her sweater and wiped my nose on her sweater, the snot off the thing. And there wasn't a pause of, what are you doing? It was this enveloping. She enveloped me. I remember this sort of magic of heat at that moment. And, you know, they cut the audition, and I remember the quietness of the room. And Joanne and I looked at each other. And when I left the room, Joanne said, don't even dare of thinking of someone else. That is Sybil. It was a huge turning point in my career, but most especially because it was the first time I really got to do my work. It was the first time I got to do what I had studied so long to do and what I was so sure I could do. And it is the time that I learned how you throw yourself so deeply in your work that it doesn't matter if you ever come back, that it's more important that you be gone. And I was gone. And many times I would have to call my mother to come pick me up and take me home. That people would, you know, they would be worried about me and how would I get out of there the day's work. And it was Joanne Woodward and it was Dan Petrie, the director.
And it was work that would win her her first award, the Emmy for Best Actress. Next would come a series of films with megastar and sex symbol Burt Reynolds. Their on-camera romance became an off-camera romance for a number of years, and Sally Field had her moment in the tabloids. But next came an extraordinary role in an extraordinary movie, and again, the course of her life changed direction.
Now, I'll do it, but I don't need your boot on my backside, Mr. Warshawski.
I've been sitting around here for 3 days.
Reuben, I'm gonna tell you something.
What are you gonna tell me, Norma?
You've been away from home a long time. You've been all business, and you're getting crabby. Reuben, you need yourself a woman.
Here's how her role in Norma Rae came about. Sally Field was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, working on one of the Burt Reynolds movies when she got a call from Marty Ritt, who she considered one of the world's greatest directors. He'd done The Long Hot Summer, HUD, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, The Great White Hope, and Sounder, among others. And he was calling to offer her the role of Norma Rae.
I mean, they were offering me a role. Offering me a role? And it wasn't an ordinary event. I hadn't read the script. I said, okay, I'll come home. I got to go home for 2 days. I hadn't read the script. And my mother, I got home. My mother was there with my two sons. While I was, 3 weeks in Alabama or wherever the heck it was I was. And so I'm dashing about, trying to get ready, not knowing what character to play as I go in. I know I have to be the character, but I don't know what the character is. So I just decide to go in beige. I remember dressing, I'll just be beige. I won't be anything. I'll just be nothing. And my mother sort of screaming to me that she read the script, and it's about it. It's about this, Southern girl, works in a mill. Huh, what kind of mill? So I went to meet Marty Ridd, and I hadn't even read the script. I was just trying to fake it. But Marty Ridd was Marty Ridd, and he was the maybe more influential even than Lee Strasberg. He was a very, very important person in my life. As a person, he taught me who I wanted to be. And as an actor, he took me on a journey. He complicated my work in ways that I hadn't done. And more than anything else, I think he applauded me. And I don't know that I heard that kind of respect that I had worked for so hard from anyone as I did from him. He would watch me do my work as I created a character. And he directed me in the most subtle of ways to complicate things. He would add things. In acting terms, he kept throwing balls at me to see how many I could keep in the air, how many things I could do at the same time. And it was this love affair of the father I didn't have, really, the real father. I mean, what you want a father to be is someone to be a taskmaster in a way, but to be... teach you in the most loving, but he was a terrible curmudgeon. If anybody knows Marty, he was known for being this curmudgeon. So it wasn't ooey gooey loving. It wasn't at all. It was, if you complained about anything, he'd say, hey, Sal, I'll run you a benefit. It was about pick yourself up, dust yourself up and off and keep on moving. You just did your work. And I became Norma. I lived there. I learned how to work in the mill. I lived with the people. And one day, Marty came into my little motorhome. And I was scared that he was coming in. What had I done? Had I done something bad? And still terribly afraid and intimidated that somehow I wouldn't be good enough. Somehow I would be found out. I wouldn't be good enough. And he came in and sat down for a minute. And he said, Sal, I want to tell you. I said, yeah, you're first rate. And I was so utterly stunned. It was all he said, you're first rate. And he got up and left. And I was shattered. It was the most important thing anyone had ever said to me.
When Sally Field won the Academy Award that year for Best Actress, he was sitting right there with her. She earned that Oscar for playing Norma Rae, but she says Martin Ritt really was Norma Rae in that he was a person who took huge personal risks, who only wanted to make films about people who struggled, people who mattered. He had been blacklisted during the McCarthy era and had survived. Sally Field had never before been around people who were political, who cared about their fellow man, and it changed her. Being Norma Rae changed her. But it was her next Oscar for the film Places in the Heart that made her an Academy Award legend, and not entirely in a good way. If you're old enough to remember the 1984 Oscars, you almost certainly already know what I'm talking about. But your memory of her acceptance speech that year is probably a little off. I discovered mine was. The speech has been misquoted so often that it's become... I can't think of any other way to say this, an alternative fact.
I know. they've made it to be what they want it to be. What it really is about performing. It is about the struggle of performing and how hard it is to hear the applause, really, when you spend all your time with your head down. My problem with this is that I wasn't terribly eloquent about it. But then I'm not really terribly eloquent. The lights were flashing, and I think I said exactly what I really meant. That the first time it happened to me, I was so scared, and it was so overwhelming that all of this was really happening to me after I had come from what I had come from, which was an impossible place to be, you know, when people wouldn't let me in the door. And I was winning my second Oscar. I said to myself, if I go up there, I must own this. It must be for me. And that's what came out.
Here is what came out. Not the gushing of an insecure girlish actress, but rather the spontaneous, authentic expression of gratitude by an actress who had worked so hard to do important work, serious work, who had transformed herself and was finally being acknowledged for what she had achieved. So with all you've heard so far in this episode, listen to it again.
But I want to say thank you to you. I haven't had an orthodox career, and I've wanted more than anything to have your respect. The first time I didn't feel it, but this time I feel it, and I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
Now 70, Sally Field is playing Amanda Wingfield in a revival of the classic Tennessee Williams play, The Glass Menagerie. It is her first time on Broadway in 15 years, and it's just where she hoped she'd be at this stage in her life. I know there are lots of other fantastic Sally Field performances we haven't covered. A quick list of highlights would have to include Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, Forrest Gump, Mrs. Doubtfire, Not Without My Daughter, and Steel Magnolias, as well as the TV shows ER and Brothers and Sisters. So there you go. It's been a 50-year-long career, and we can't cover it all. But I want to end this episode the way Sally Field ended her talk to students at the Academy of Achievement Summit in 2008, because it's a pretty great takeaway. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is what it takes from the Academy of Achievement.
Joseph Campbell said, "You must enter the forest in the darkest part, where there is no path, because where there is a path, it's someone else's." And it's absolutely true. But I say, you must enter the forest again and again and again and again, where there is no path. Because not only is the fear that it will be somebody else's, but even worse, it may be your own. And you're retreading over your own path. Enter the forest, holding your own hand in the very darkest place. Thanks.
What It Takes is made possible with funding from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.